Hello and welcome to the latest instalment of the Meg podcast. Another one that is slightly delayed from when we planned it due to real life, but I think it's only about a month since we last did one. So it's I think it's always nice to get if we can do one a month. But, you know, as we always say, it's an irregular thing. We do it when we feel like it. We do it when we've got a subject. On this one, I am again, as ever, joined by Richard Jeffrey Cook and Matt Haywood. Good evening, chaps.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So some people may be relieved to know that we return to our normal sort of scheduling in this one, where instead of listening to me rabbit on too long, Richard will be handling a historical topic in his usual, a very competent way and more concise than I am. We will be looking at some lists as usual, and we'll also see where conversation takes us around various things. So without further ado, and without telling you what it's going to be, because I'm going to leave it to Richard, I'll let Richard introduce the topic of this podcast. So over to you, Richard.
Thank you, Nick. So today we are talking about the third century crisis. And this is the third century crisis of Rome, if anybody was wondering. So we are talking about a 50-year period from 235 to 284. In the Common Era, or Anno Domini, if you prefer. So the crisis begins with the assassination of the Emperor Severus Alexander by his own troops. So if you know anything about Severus, the more famous Severus always offered the advice, make sure you keep your own troops happy. Well, obviously, Severus Alexander didn't follow this advice. The crisis ends actually with the military victories of Aurelian and then the accession of Diocletian and his reforms that split the empire so that it's ruled by two Augustuses and two Caesars. And that fundamentally leads to the divisions of the Western Roman Empire and the Eastern Roman Empire, and obviously the West then collapses, leaving the Eastern Roman Empire to become the Byzantine Empire. So at the time of 235 CE, the Roman Empire had been a military dictatorship for over 300 years. So becoming emperor had relied on a combination of the Senate, popular approval, and the acceptance of the army. As the Senate had declined in importance, so the role of the army became more important. When Severus Alexander was assassinated, the Pannonian legions elected Maximinus Thrax as the new emperor. Basically, he was a more aggressive sort. And the reason Severus Alexander had upset the troops was basically by attempting to bribe the Germans rather than fight them. So Maximinus Thrax goes on in 235. He defeats the Germans, and then in 235-36 goes on to fight the Dacians and Sarmatians. Carrying on in 238, there was a revolt that flared up in Africa. Now, in 238, Maximinus is still in Pannonia, so he's still fighting the barbarians to the north. And basically the Africans proclaim a chap called Gordian and his son co-emperors. The Senate, in what might have been rather a rash move, switches their allegiance. And as a result, Maximinus decides to immediately march on Rome. Meanwhile, the revolt in Africa does not go well. The governor of Numidia holds a grudge against the Gordians, kills the son, and Gordian himself decides to hang himself commit suicide. Meanwhile, the Senate suddenly find they've got nobody left to support. So they really can't expect any clemency from Maximinus. So they elect two of their own number, Pupienus, I may have pronounced that wrong, apologies if I have, and Balbinus as co-emperors. But unfortunately, due to their unpopularity with the mob in Rome, they also have to appoint Gordian's grandson, this is Gordian III, as Caesar. So that's a sort of junior emperor. Meanwhile, Maximinus has got stuck besieging Aquileia. And as his troops, basically, because he rushed there without sorting out his sources of supply, the troops start to starve. And so the legionaries of the Second Parthica decide, not having this, and assassinate Maximinus Thrax. At this point, Pupienus and Balbinus are both murdered by the Praetorian Guard. And so Rome is left with Gordian III as the sole surviving emperor. With me, I'll be asking questions later.
I'm confused already. So I've read about this a few times. I always get confused.
Yeah, essentially, all the candidates for emperor have either been killed or hung themselves in a three-year period, really. So Gordian III, he's still only 13 at this point, and this basically leaves the Senate in charge. And in 241, a chap called Timestheus, again, apologies if I mispronounce that, was appointed chief of the Praetorian Guard, and he has the idea of marrying Gordian to his daughter. In effect, he has become ruler of the empire, even though he's not officially emperor. So taking advantage of this perceived weakness in the Roman Empire, the Sassanid Persian emperor, Shapur I, then decides he's going to invade Roman Mesopotamia. This is a threat that can't be ignored, so Timestheus and Gordian basically travel over to the east with a large army, and they actually defeat the Persians at the Battle of Resena, R-E-S-A-E-N-A, that's how it's spelled, so I hope it's pronounced Resena, and that's in 243. However, shortly after this, Timestheus actually dies. The circumstances are very unclear as to how it actually happened, and it could have been assassination, it could have been natural causes even. Anyway, this sort of halts the campaign in its footsteps, because the Romans had been planning to advance on Ctesiphon, which is the capital of the Sassanid Persian Empire. But they get halted by the Sassanids at the Battle of Misishi. I'm sure whoever makes up these names just hates people who try to broadcast on podcasts. Battle of Misishi is in 244. M-I-S-I-C-H-E, if anybody's interested. So at this point, Gordian III has died. And again, exactly how that happens is unclear. If you were a cynical, suspicious person, you probably suspect assassination. Anyway, this leaves a chap called Philip the Arab, who was Praetorian prefect at this time, i.e. in charge of the Praetorian Guard. He becomes emperor. So you start rattling through the emperors at a fairly brisk pace at this point. So Philip needs to secure his position in Rome. So he makes a hasty treaty with the Persians, concedes some territory to the Persians. And this is basically his later undoing, because this was seen as shamefully giving in to the enemy, and actually faces a big problem at this point, because He actually needs a lot of money to pay his troops, and he also owes a massive tribute to the Persians. So he thinks, great, the way I'll save some money is stop paying our subsidies to the German tribes. Guess what? This upsets the German tribes. So in 245, the Carpi cross the Danube. Meanwhile, the Armenians have refused to acknowledge Shapur I as their ruler, and so the war with Persia has flared up again. So Rome at this point is fighting wars on both the Danube frontier and the Persian frontier. So in 248, the legions fighting the Carpi in Pannonia and Mysia are basically unhappy with how the war is going, rebel. In the resulting confusion, the Quadi and other tribes also cross the frontier. And in desperation to quell this rebellion, Philip sends one of his supporters, a chap called Decius, to deal with the problem. This backfires because in 249, Decius is proclaimed emperor by the Danubian legions. So Philip has to go off and fight Decius, and they meet in two battles. And sorry, they meet the two armies meet in a battle. This is the Battle of Verona in 249, and this one Decius easily wins. So with all the chaos going on, the Goths under their king, Cniva, or Neva, I'm not sure, again, I'm not sure how it's pronounced. They cross the Danube. They start besieging Nicopolis, but they actually get surprised by a Roman force. But then they recover and actually defeat the Romans at the Battle of Berrhoe, Beroe, and that was in 250. Decius then raises another army, but is defeated and killed by the Goths at the Battle of Arbretus, and that's in 251. So need another emperor at this point. So the next one is a chap called Gallus, who was a family friend of Decius. To secure the withdrawal of the Goths, he basically allows them to keep all their plunder and captives and agrees an annual subsidy for them. So that's the way he secures peace. Meanwhile, a revolt erupts in Syria and Cappadocia, and the Persians, under Shapur I, invade Armenia and destroy a Roman army at the Battle of Barbalissos, and that's in 253. Shapur then goes on to raid Syria and actually gets as far as the city of Antioch. And in fact, a second invasion by the Persians actually gets repelled by a descendant of the royal house of Emesa, actually raising troops locally and beating the Persians. So in that way, you see that the Romans are actually starting to rely on former rulers of the Greek territories to actually defend their frontier here. Meanwhile, on the Danube frontier, the Sarmatians have again invaded the Balkans, and they do this in both 252 and 253. The governor of Mysia and Pannonia is defeated by these invaders. Oh, sorry, run, no, wrong way around. He defeats the invaders and then gets proclaimed emperor by his legions. And this is a chap called Aemilian. And before the legions loyal to Gallus can arrive, he catches up with Gallus at a place called Interamna and kills him. Aemilian himself only survives 3 more months before a larger force under a chap called Valerian would arrive. And Valerian had been loyal to to Gaius, and the troops under Aemilian mutiny, and they kill off Aemilian. So yet another situation where we've had an emperor killed by his own troops.
How many are we up to now?
I lose track. I really do. Back in the east, Shapur has actually taken the Armenian kingdom, and he's installed a vassal ruler in Antioch. It takes Valerian until 257 to actually re-establish Roman control in Syria. By 259, he actually moves on to Edessa and gets decisively defeated at the Battle of Edessa in 260 and is captured by the Persians. He probably remains in captivity until he dies, which we believe was around 264. So not terribly good for the stability of the Roman Empire.
It's going well.
So on seizing the throne, Valerian had actually appointed his son Gallienus as co-emperor. Between 253 and 258, while Valerian was in the east, Gallienus has been campaigning in the Rhine and Danube areas, and actually successfully prevents any major invasions during this period. But after the defeat of Edessa, Gallienus has to act with speed, because there are revolts by three different individuals: Ingenus, Regalianus, and Postumus. But all three of those rebellions are actually quelled. But in 258, while this is going on, a major Alemannic and Frankish invasion occurs. The Franks themselves actually reach as far south as southern Spain. Meanwhile, the Alemanni and the Jugurthi actually invade Italy, and they get as far south as the outskirts of Rome. Gallienus actually intercepts them and defeats them near Milan at the Battle of Mediolanus. That's in 259, while they're actually heading back north again. So the empire is in a pretty shabby state at this point. You've had the East invaded, you've had the Balkans invaded, you've had Gaul and Spain invading, you've had Italy invaded. So now the Sarmatians take advantage and raid the province of Pontus, which involves crossing the Black Sea. And this is shows actually how the security of the Roman Empire has deteriorated by this point. The Persians themselves actually raid Cilicia and Cappadocia, and it actually takes a local official, a chap called Macrianus, with the help of the Palmyrian army under Odenathus, their king, to actually turn the tide against Shapur. Macrianus then decides he's going to invade Europe, and the Pannonian legions actually also rebel due to the absence of Gallienus while he's been dealing with these other problems. So Gallienus actually sends a supporter of his, Aureolus, to actually suppress the rebels. During this chaos, Gallienus actually loses control of Britain, Spain, Germany, and parts of Gaul to another general, Postumus, one of the ones who rebelled earlier. And they had all taken advantage of this revolt by Macrianus. So Postumus actually establishes what is known as the Gallic Empire, and basically those provinces, Britain, Spain, Germany, and parts of Gaul, remain independent until they are conquered by Aurelian in 274. So where are we now? We've now reached about 260 AD. And in 262, we get a revolt led by Aemilianus in Egypt. This is defeated by a chap called Theodotus, who had been sent by Gallienus, and that occurred at a battle near Thebes. This is Thebes in Egypt, not Thebes in Greece. There then is a bit of stability, but in 267, and for the following 2 years, the Goths and Heruls actually invade the Balkans, both by land and by sea, reaching as far south as Athens and Sparta. The history at this point gets very confusing, and it's actually very unclear if there was a single invasion or whether there were two independent invasions. But Gallienus has to react to this, and he wins first a battle in Thrace, but then a more decisive battle occurs at Naissus. This, however, may have been won by Gallienus' successor, Claudius, rather than Gallienus himself. We actually don't know. So in 268, the authority of Gallienus is challenged by Aureolus. Sorry about the pronunciations. And a decisive battle takes place again near Mediolanum, Milan in Italy. But during the subsequent siege, Gallienus actually gets murdered. So he's actually replaced by Claudius. This is often referred to as Claudius II, not unnaturally, because Claudius I obviously was much earlier.
The more famous and one.
Claudius II gets to only rule for 2 years before dying of a pestilence. Now, this is probably actually the plague of Cyprian, which is a particularly nasty disease that ravages the empire at this time. One of the theories goes that actually with all the invasions that the empire had suffered, this helped spread this plague throughout the empire, possibly not. In late 268, Claudius had actually routed the Alemanni at the Battle of Lake Benicus. But when he dies, he would be succeeded by his brother Quintilius. But Quintilius actually only survives a few weeks before dying, either assassinated or forced suicide, we're not quite sure which, by the legions, who then elevate Aurelian to the throne. Now, Aurelian would be the chap who goes on to reunite the empire, defeating in turn the Alemanni, the Goths, the Vandals, the Uthungi, the Sarmatians, and the Carpi. In 273, he goes on to conquer the Palmyrene Empire, which had sort of declared, almost declared themselves as actually rightful successors to the Roman Empire in the east. They had expanded as far as Egypt. And in 274, Aurelian goes on to conquer the Gallic Empire, so reunites sort of Gaul, Germany, Spain, and Britain into the rest of the Roman Empire. However, he is actually murdered by officers of the Praetorian Guard when he starts to go off to campaign against the Persians. So he didn't have a particularly long reign as emperor. However, Aurelian would be the chap who sets the groundwork. And although there are a few more emperors, none of them lasted long, but it's then that Diocletian appears, and we get the reform of the empire and a new era of stability. Actually, after the death of Aurelian, the army actually allows the Senate to choose the next emperor. Mm-hmm. They actually choose a capable but rather aged leader of the Senate, a chap called Tacitus, not the historian.
It'd be a bit old by then.
dead. And Tacitus actually dies of a fever after a reign of about 6 months. Tacitus is succeeded by his half-brother, but he gets murdered about 2 months later. The next emperor is Probus, who had been appointed by Aurelian as commander in the east. Probus actually, when his legion suggests he should become emperor, actually refers this to the Senate. And the Senate actually confirms the choice. This seems an unusual act of humility by people proclaimed emperors their legions, but maybe it was a wise idea. He goes on to actually defeat the Goths on the Lower Danube. That's in 277, and then campaigns against the Alemanni in 278, restoring the Rhine frontier. In 279 to 280, he actually fights the Vandals. And then puts down an invasion by the Blemmi in Egypt. I don't think he does that personally. I think that's one of his subordinates. In fact, during 280 to 281, he actually had to put down a further three revolts, but actually falls to victim to an assassin engaged by the supporters of the fourth usurper, a chap called Carus. In 283, Carus sets out against the Quadian Sarmatians and inflicts a severe defeat on them. But he then proceeds to invade the Persian Empire, which the Persian Empire is having problems of its own at this stage because it's getting invaded from the east by the Hephthalites. So Carus himself may have actually got as far as Ctesiphon. But he actually dies, reportedly being struck by lightning, which seems slightly unlikely. But if you're wearing all that armor, maybe it's a possibility. maybe not.
Call me silly.
Carus himself is actually succeeded by his sons Carinus and Numerian. Numerian, I think he is. Sorry, I've got my vowels the wrong way around there. Sorry, consonants the wrong way around. Numerian. Numerian actually returns with the army to Rome, but he is actually murdered in Thrace on the way back. At this point is when Diocletian takes control of the army and defeating Carinus at the Battle of the Margus River ends the crisis of the third century. So during that period, a 50-year period, you almost end up with one emperor or usurper a year. Many of them, very few of them, dying in their beds, it has to be said. And those that do seem to mostly die of plague, but quite a large number of them dying at the hands of their own troops.
Yes.
this probably happens because the core of it, you could say, stems back to Severus and his treatment of the legions, paying them, increasing their pay rates and paying them donatives to ensure their support. This and the economic struggles of the empire make it harder and harder for emperors to actually afford to pay the troops enough to keep, and that undoubtedly is a contributory factor to why so many emperors get killed off by their own troops.
Yeah, so that, it does make you wonder why anybody wanted to become emperor at this point.
Yeah, well, of course you don't hear about the guys who very discreetly decided they did not want to be emperor and kept their heads down.
Yeah, it is. It's
and you've got to figure that once your soldiers have thrown your hat in the ring, if you say no, you're still a dead man, because whoever succeeds is probably going to come looking for you just in case.
Absolutely, yes. I think there are several examples actually where you have the suspicion that the emperors involved didn't actually were rather stuffed by their own legions nominating them as emperor when they would perhaps have preferred not to have been. But
yeah, so when the armies did elect a new emperor, decided that their general was going to be the emperor. I suppose when we say the armies, well, I suspect we mean the officer corps, really, don't we? Are they really doing it? Is it down to money?
I think in a lot of cases, it's that they know their commander. They don't know the chap who otherwise is officially emperor. So they're looking after their own interests.
Right.
Certainly the reason they then go on to assassinate so many of their commanders, I think, is probably because those commanders either can't raise the taxes to pay them, or they, for whatever decisions they make, the troops are then not happy with. And so we've made you emperor, we can unmake you emperor.
Yeah. Got one question about the Palmyrans for you. Because we know at the time the Palmyrans, obviously very influential, and as you said, you know, effectively break away from the Roman Empire. Do you think they're actually trying to set up something different from the Roman Empire, or is it a bit like the Gallic Empire, which is still a Roman Empire, just, you know, a more localized one?
Yeah, I'm not a huge expert on Palmyran history, but I think it's probably they want to establish themselves as a dynasty controlling a Roman Empire in the East,
right? Yeah,
to put it like that. So Palmyra was an important trading city between Persia and the sort of Mediterranean world. A lot of the Arab caravans traveled through Palmyra. So by this time they were a heavily Roman influenced Eastern dynasty, and as a result were perfectly acceptable to Romans in the Greek world, shall we put it like that. So in Asia Minor, Syria, Palestine, and Egypt. We have to remember at this time you didn't have social media or television or anything like that. So any knowledge of an emperor was pretty vague and probably restricted to images on coins and that sort of thing. So you probably weren't, if somebody turns up and says this is the new emperor and they happen to be Palmyran rather than Roman, to the vast majority, if they've already just shown their credibility by beating a Persian army that was invading Syria, they would seem to be a reasonable choice. I mean, a lot of the emperors, of course, didn't actually come from Rome or Italy. Severus himself, of course, comes from North Africa.
Yeah.
So, and you've got Philip the Arab, who I suspect was not of Italian stock. I think they can claim as much credibility as the next emperor in those circumstances.
To add to that one, I mean, I looked into it because I did the Palmyrian list for this podcast, and Odentheus actually takes the title King of Kings and nominally pays tribute to the Roman emperors. Doesn't actually pay him anything, but he actually besieged the Sassanid capital at one point as well after Valerian died. Yeah. Just randomly, is Valerian the one that they theoretically poured gold down his throat to kill him? Is that, no, that is Crassus. He the one of them?
Well, they do that to Crassus, certainly.
One of the myths for Valerian was
footstool
that Shapa used him as a mounting block, mounting block, and possibly had him stuffed when he died and carried on using him afterwards. I think that's one of them.
I don't think they killed Valerian, so I don't think the gold one is Valerian, because they kept him as a captive.
Makes you wonder what they were trying to do with him. perhaps it's one of those, we don't know what to do with him.
We've never captured one before.
We don't think we should kill him, but what do we do with him?
Well, if you get invaded, sending a ruler you captured back to start a rebellion in the original territory was quite a common tactic throughout the whole of the Persian period. So,
I'm trying to remember. I'm sure there's one where probably not even Roman, some ruler was capped. I think it's when a Ming emperor was captured by the Mongols in about 1450. They literally sort of go, what do we do with him? And I think they sent him back on the grounds that we don't actually know what we're going to do with this chap. So they were just confused.
Certainly the Parthians do it with at least one Seleucid emperor.
They did, that's right.
It's only, as far as I can tell, it's only Manius Aquilius and Marcus Licinius Crassus who had molten gold poured down their throats.
Yeah.
Lucky them.
Wrong.
Apparently Valerian may have had it. There you go.
It was a very heavy footstool by the time they finished then.
Yeah, but I think there's another one where it's that after he died, they flayed his skin off and dyed it red and hung it up in a temple. There's another one. I think I've read, unless I'm confusing that with somebody else. 101 Atrocities of the Ancient World.
Yes. Yeah, you could write a book on it. Somebody probably has.
I suspect there's a couple out there.
Yeah. I was just going to say, and Odentheus's wife, of course, was the famous Zenobia.
Of course. Yeah.
So, you know, the beloved of all war gamers who fancy doing a Palmyrian army.
Yeah, we'll not delve into the reasons behind that, shall we? the psychology behind war gamers' obsession with Zenobia.
Yes, indeed.
Anyway, from the history, one thing you can conclude is that we had lots of armies to choose from when picking army lists for the third century crisis.
We did indeed, which is a nice prompt for us to give Richard some time off from after that. So thank you very much, Richard, because it's another intensive period of history, obviously, and one with names appear and disappear with quite frightening rapidity at times. So. It's an interesting one to read up on, but also plagued by lack of sources again, isn't it? It's one of those periods.
There are some major gaps, particularly during the 250s and 260s, where we're quite unsure of some of the sequence of events.
It is, yeah. So anyway, to go on to the army lists now, as Richard said, there are a lot of army lists for this. We've chosen a small number to talk about this evening, possibly notable by the ones we don't choose as well, which maybe we'll touch on after we've gone through these. But I'm going to kick off with an early imperial Roman. So we'll start with the Rome. Say, you know, the early part of the history Richard was on about. So often seen as the classic Roman army, although by the third century, they weren't looking so much like the classic Roman army. The famous sort of rectangular scutum was dropping out of use. The weaponry was changing a bit. You know, the gladius was being replaced by a longer sword. But basically, the army is quite recognisable in its setup. We're talking legions, auxilia, and supporting cast of cavalry and other bits and pieces. So obviously the list itself is in the Italy PDF. It's army number 2516 in there. And I'm sure quite a lot of people have looked at it. So for this one, I'm going to pick one at the early end of the third century crisis. I've actually dated it 245 CE, but the date actually isn't terribly relevant to the composition. I've chosen to include an ally in this. I'm basing the army in Syria, and the ally is an Armenian ally, for reasons which I think will become obvious as we look at it. So for the Roman part of it, I've just gone with three competent professional generals. We've got the poor unfortified camp that is mandatory, but I haven't upgraded it any further than that. Just for reference, the terrain types are standard coastal and mountains, which is typical for Romans, so there's plenty of choice there. The army composition itself, I've got four base units of equites, cavalry drilled loose, average protected, unskilled javelin, short spear. So just four bases. I view those as probably going to be more used as skirmishy types. They're not going to lead any attacks, but a pair of them operating together can be really, really useful. I've done that in a number of armies. This allows you flexibility for holding things up. I've gone for two units of veteran legionaries, each of six bases. Drilled flexible infantry, superior, protected, impact weapon, shield cover, and melee expert. So obviously they're good hefty strike force. I've gone for two smaller units of legionaries, and these are average. There's four bases, but one of the bases has been given the experienced bolt shooters that you're allowed to add to a base within a legionary UG. So we've got three bases that are just average protected, impact weapon, shield cover, and melee expert. And one base is the same, but has experienced bolt shooters. I've got two of those units. And people who have been around the Meg circuit a while will know that. So that's something I've definitely picked up from Paul Stovell, who used them a number of times. Although I believe when he first used them, he downgraded those units to poor. But such the nasty list owner, the listmeister, decided that, yeah, that's probably a bit iffy if they've got bolt shooters. You can't have poor and have the attached bolt shooters. Legion isn't competent enough to do that. Anyway, it's two units of that. And obviously they're going to be supporting units. The bolt shooters obviously can shoot over other units at times as well. So they've got quite a few support options there. Got two units of auxilia. Again, six base units, drilled flexible, average protected, unskilled javelin, short spear, melee expert. So they are legionaries light. And I think like a lot of people, I've just gone for the absolute minimum on that because they're not quite as tough as the legions. In some ways you go, oh, I wish we could have another two units of legionaries, but they are a bit cheaper and they're still pretty competent. You know, don't knock them. They can hang around, and if they don't get swept away by a fierce charge from, say, barbarian infantry, they've got melee expert, and they can certainly win in the long run. The last unit I've got in the Roman component is just a unit of slingers, a skirmish unit. So it's infantry skirmishers, poor, unprotected, experienced sling, combat shy, but nine bases. Always like to have the odd unit of skirmishers lying around. Bit of projected shooting there can help drive off some pesky enemy at times. The Armenian ally, which I mentioned earlier, I've gone with a competent instinctive ally general. And then there's three units of Armenian cavalry. They're all formed loose, protected, charging lancer. One is guard cavalry, they're superior. And the other two are just ordinary ones and are average and melee expert. And they're all sixes. There's also a small unit of Armenian horse archers because they're compulsory, and to fit them in, I've downgraded them to well, basically as cheap as you can get them. Poor, unprotected, unskilled bow, combat shy. So the four bases are 27 points. That's partly deliberate, because with a competent general commanding the ally, you really want to concentrate on the charging cavalry and don't get yourself distracted by the horse archers. You know, you might find a use for them, but don't stress about it. So I think, you know, obviously in use, it's got some punch between the veteran legionary units and the three Armenian cavalry units, and quite a lot of staying power. I think the bits could work very well together. I'll just make one comment. The Armenians in the list, if you took the list a little bit earlier, you could actually have them as cataphracts. But they're a lot more expensive. And if you went down that option, you would probably, unless you made other changes in the list, you'd probably only have two units of Armenian cavalry, but they would be cataphracts, or, you know, armoured horse, fully armoured, long spear, devastating charger and shove. And it'd probably come out the same points. And you'd end up with, let's say, without making any other changes, 10 tugs in this. As it is, I've got 11 tugs, so the army breaks on 6. It's got a PBS of 7 and a scouting of 3. There you are. I will obviously at this point open it up to comment. Maybe start with Matt, just to give Richard a little bit longer before he comes in and tells me it's illegal for some reason, which is quite traditional when we get to the army lists.
It's a good list. I like it. I'm more inclined to the charging this version than taking the cataphracts out of it, because I think the cataphracts are tribal in the Armenian list.
They are, yes, tribal close.
Which I think with this style of army, you probably want slightly greater speed and the ease of maneuverability, particularly with a competent instinctive general. Once you start having to move tribals around, it just gets all very messy. It's a perfectly sane. Obviously, I wouldn't use it because it's perfectly sane in the Imperial list.
Well, no, it does have the option, you know, terrain, put those woods down and put the cavalry in it. You know, we know you like that. Although lancers are not so good as, you know.
Cataphracts.
Yeah.
Honestly, if anybody thinks I'm joking, try fighting cataphracts in the wood with just about anything. You will lose, because you're still fighting fully armoured. It doesn't matter if they're naked. It's a forest, so you're affected. The cataphracts are badly affected. So, all right, so that's a plus one on your side, but that's cancelled out by the fully armoured. Yeah. And then you've got whatever weaponry they've got. They're probably on a higher factor than most of your infantry fighting in woods, in forests.
Yes, yeah, so it has to be forest, doesn't it? To make it difficult going, so that even loose formation infantry are affected.
Yes, exactly.
Richard's Matt is to lure them into the forest and then not fight them.
Yes, just walk away and leave them moving.
They're bound to go slower than you will.
It's an expensive way to lure. Put 1500 points of cataphracts in the forest just to sit there and go, nobody's coming to play. But anyway, no, it's a good list. I do like it. And
my thinking behind it was it's not one that's got any unusual things to surprise on people. But the cavalry, you're absolutely right. They're in there as the formed loose for the extra speed and ease of manoeuvre. They're a bit easier to manoeuvre than if they were cataphracts. Sorry, Richard, I should let you...
I think it's a solid, competent army list. The small legionary units, the fours with the bolt shooter, my only concern, I suppose, is whether you've got enough troops to form the line. But there's not really a weak spot, certainly.
I'd be expecting to, certainly not expecting to have a line that covers most of the width of the table. And no. So that's why there's two of the Equites units to, you know, to sort of act in tandem for slowing somebody up on one flank, perhaps. With two of them, the hope is that only one has had to run away and the other can then scamper back up there, and being drilled, they can turn and move easier than if they were formed. So
yeah, they can also be quite good in a sort of reserve position. So yeah, if the enemy rushes forward in pursuit or the player gets reckless, you might hit something in the flank, and a four hitting in the flank can always ruin somebody else's day.
Yes.
So yeah, no, I'd like it. It's sort of army I would quite happily command.
Yeah, I'm not claiming anything out of the ordinary with it.
And but I can't even find an error in it. It looks to be legal as well.
Oh dear, well, that's gonna have to resign from the podcast, aren't I? So do that. So well, so there we are. Just before we move on from this one, you know, as I said, I only took the minimum of the auxilia. In theory, as far as I'm aware, a significant Roman army might have half its infantry auxilia. Does that reflect a bit of a weakness, if you like, with Meg, or the points? They're slightly overcosted compared to the legionaries.
The problem is that there are exceptions where probably you didn't have the same ratio of auxilia to legions. That's always a tricky one. If you want a completely historical representative Roman army, then probably yes, you should have roughly equal numbers of auxilia and legions. But as I've commented elsewhere, the minimums are quite low, which actually probably makes it of more interest for competition gamers. In terms of the points, I don't know. You look at the point system, you think actually it ought to be about right, but I don't know, for some reason I always find short spear troops seem to be slightly at a disadvantage, and I've never quite figured out why, because you do the maths and it ought to be about reasonable.
Ever since I started, you know, Paul Cummins, who likes his stats and number crunching, has always said that sort of bang for buck, short spear melee experts are really, really good combination. And there's some,
drilled flexible is always an expensive.
It could be that, and maybe
that's the bit that is arguably not always worth the points, because how often actually do you get that benefit from being drilled flexible, particularly if the entire army is drilled flexible?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. That said, actually, you know, despite that question, you know, I would say, you know, that in terms of a competition point system, Meg, I think, does extremely well, because we get such a variety of armies that are actually competitive. You know,
I think it's better than any other system I've played. So
yeah. All I'm doing here is picking a particular bit out of the line, because it's the reason I've heard people say they would prefer to take the Imperial Roman list, the following one, rather than the early, because it doesn't have an auxilia minima.
But I think if you took the legions out of that list and it was in any other type of list, those auxilia would actually be really nice troops to have.
Yes, I think you're right.
It's only because the legions do everything they do better.
Yes. Yeah, they've got impact weapon and shield cover.
And they can operate in terrain better just than the better because of the impact weapon. So yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a quirk, isn't it? It's just one of those things. But anyway, moving on from that, Matt. Shall we see your offering?
Well, I as I mentioned earlier, I went with Palmyrian because well, they've got cataphracts, and well, you know, me and cataphracts and forests, and anyway, so Palmyrian list, it's in book 28, which is the classical Syria and Asia Minor book. I went for the date of 260, which is Valerian's death and the start of Palmyrian pseudo independence, or unofficial independence is probably a better way of putting it. I went with a Bedouin ally. So I'll get to that in a minute. So I went talented professional. I kind of went out of favor with talented army commanders for a while, but I found talented professionals, particularly with the slight reduction in points in the new 2024 lists, is starting to hit the sweet spot for me, because it's a big bonus on the PBS and the scouting, and the four card army commander with professional generals who can either float or if he commands troops, you know, hand out the single card to other professional generals. Really, it's almost a force multiplier for me at the moment.
I am tending to move that way a little more myself as well. As you know from discussions about army lists before Beachhead, I think you talked me into it in a way for the Seldric army I took. You're right. It was only 50 point change difference, but it's just enough to bring them into consideration in some armies, in my view. So that worked, Richard. At least for me and Matt, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. They didn't bribe me, honestly.
I think it was, I can't remember who's raised it initially. Well, a number of people have, but in my mind, I think it might have been Lee Sanders mentioned it at some point.
And it was notable with the stats that I looked at BritCon, where none of the top 10 had talented army commanders.
I think that was the point at which I made note of it, certainly. Yeah. BritCon last year.
Anyway, sorry, Matt, back to your list.
So talented professional, competent instinctive Bedouin ally, a competent professional subgeneral, and a mediocre professional subgeneral, which is a total of 12 command cards. Which again, I think works okay with this army. The PBS comes out at 8, the scouting is 4, its tugs break 5, total lugs is 12, which is 4 for third deployment. So, onto the army. We have 2 tugs of cataphracts, cavalry formed close, armored horse, fully armored, long spear, dev charger, shove, so full fat, literally. One is superior, one is average, so guard or royal bodyguards, whatever they are. So you've got the superiors and an average, one each of 6s. And then you've got 3 tugs of Roman legionaries. The list has a requirement that if it's after 268, they all have to be in the same command. This is 260, so it's beforehand, so they can scatter across any of the commands in the army, which I think is much more useful. Anyway, so Roman legionaries, standard Roman legionary, infantry, drilled flex, average, protected, impact weapon, shield cover, melee expert. These also have integral shooters, though. So 3 tugs of 6. Compulsory archers, which are infantry, tribal loose, average, unprotected, experienced, bow, combat shy, the minimum 6 for the list. Then we have the Roman cavalry, standard Roman cavalry. Formed loose, average, protected, unskilled javelin, short spear, melee expert. And then we come on to the Bedouin ally, which is Bedouin cavalry, the formed flex, average, unprotected, long spear, 2 tugs, one of which is combat shy. I needed the points, basically. And finally we have Bedouin armored cavalry, which are cavalry formed loose, superior protected, long spear, another block of 6. So that gives you army size of 10 tugs. I'd prefer 11, but I was making too many compromises to get it to 11. And I've actually found that I quite like 10s because you can put a unit in ambush and most people discount it. Because they think, well, why is anybody going to go with 10? Particularly if it's a non-compulsory. So put the superior cataphracts on the table and ambush a unit of cataphracts. I hesitate to say in a forest, but you know,
I was going to say, the main flaw of the forest is that the terrain of Palmyrens is plains and desert.
Absolutely, yes. I'd forgotten to mention plains and desert. So therefore, I need to invade and make sure they have forests. But anyway. and to round it off, there were two units of really rubbish skirmishing archers, which are infantry skirmishers, poor, unprotected, unskilled bow combat, shy, 2 blocks of 6. Of absolutely no use to the army other than it makes me up to 12 ugs for the deployment. And they offer an additional screen, particularly if I wanted to screen off the cavalry or even the legionaries, if I, because they are in sixes. So anything that stops people shooting, even with the shield cover, I'm all for. So there you go. That's it. That was the sum of my thinking on the subject.
Yeah, I see you've gone with the integral shooters for the Roman legionaries. Why, I suppose, is my question.
Because they're in sixes, they are somewhat vulnerable to shock cavalry. People are not probably going to want to fight the cavalry that is in the army. Two cataphracts and the superior long spear plus flanking Bedouins is probably not a particular, unless you're a very large cavalry army. The infantry can just stand there if something that I don't want to fight.
Okay.
It swings and roundabouts. I'm slightly taken with integral shooters because I use them both in my Arabs beachhead, and I fought Lance's Italian Lombards, I think it was. And he had a Nikephorian Byzantine ally. All right, they are long spear foot integral shooters, but they make a very useful block of just standing in the center of the table, occupying space. So it's an experiment. I will admit that it's quite expensive for it.
I mean, I just note that for the same points, you could have had your second Bedouin cavalry as not combat shy. And I'm just not a fan of the Bedouin cavalry being combat shy. I think they're too vulnerable.
I wouldn't disagree with that, but I was only going to fight with two of the units anyway. So
I love it. Yeah, I know what you mean by that. But I found that because I've used quite often just a four of those, and you start sending them around a flank and people start overreacting to them. It's just ideally you wouldn't. The legionaries with integral shooters, for average ones, I'm a bit with Matt on this one. It can be really useful, especially if you can plonk them in front of something that's going to have a forced charge. So that they charge you. Obviously, they're absolutely useless if you're facing cataphracts. Let's say these Palmyrens are chasing down some invading Goths. even if the legionaries get to a base width away and have them force charge themselves, they're drilled, so you can hold them reasonably easily. If the enemy charge in, you do get that extra factor. Possibly in this army, though, those legionaries are going to have to charge more than they might in some other armies. So I can see it ending up being not that useful, given the overall composition here.
And I think I was also looking to replace the superior, because if I could have veteran legionaries, I wouldn't take the integral shooters, obviously. But
it's pretty much what I do. If they're superior, I just don't consider it. If it's average, it's in play, sort of thing, as a possible, depending on the points. Can I just give you just one thought about the overall composition of this? And I think it gets it with nearly all Palmyran armies I've seen, is it just never seems to have enough of something to get oomph.
Yes. I worked out a list that I absolutely loved and then realized it was illegal.
What was it, 14,000 points?
No. The Bedouin Allied, I'd taken two of the Bedouin Allies and two of the Armored Cavalry.
Oh, I see.
It's limited to one per command, which I hadn't twigged initially. And I think it made it a very nice cavalry army, because those superior long spears, as we often discuss, they're absolutely brutal.
Oh, they can. That the cancelling of mounted melee expert they can give can be. They can get into a situation that where they're up when the opponent doesn't think they're going to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the superior long spears are nice. Cavalry, that's for sure. Yeah.
Well, let's face it; they're nearly as expensive as average cataphracts.
Yes,
and apart from the charge, they're probably better. just stuff as that. Yeah, Palmyra, it does feel to me one of those armies you can never quite. Yeah, you do want that extra 1,000-1,500 points. You know, it'll do a great 10,000 point army at 11,000 points.
Yes. Yeah.
more. You know, you can say that about obviously almost every army. Like, oh, if only I had a few extra points, something. But the Palmyrans are one of those. I need another 10%.
There are a number of armies where I've never really been happy with a list because I feel it needs one extra unit I can't afford.
Yeah,
and they definitely fall into that category. I'd agree.
Yeah, because I've got one somewhere. I think it has. It's quite. It doesn't have the Roman Legion. It's got three units of cataphracts and I think a big chunk of. Horse archers. I take it there aren't any compulsory horse archers in this list.
No, unless I've made a very big boom.
He says, you know, I think I did one that was lots of horse archers, three units of cataphracts, no legions, and a Bedouin ally. And it's
the horse archers are 0 to 24.
I didn't think you'd have missed that, but it suddenly struck me. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Dan, we haven't caught you out with this one either. It's just a frustrating list, I find, in that respect. I think this one's as good as any I've seen. I just wouldn't take it.
Yeah, it's one I'd love to for historical reasons, in that I think probably my second or third army ever was a Palmyra.
Right.
But, I just can't. It, as you say, it's one that works at 1,100 points almost rather than
1,100.
Good God!
Although if it was 1,100, it's really good.
Yeah.
The opponents are so confused because you've got two generals and a unit or something. You're using something really rubbish.
All right.
Anyway, okay. Should we move on to Richard's list then?
So I went with the opponent of the Palmyrans at this period, which is the early Sassanid Persian list 2613 from the Persian, Iran and India classical set. And it has standard plains and mountains as terrain, and I took it with a poor fortified camp. It's got an Armenian ally. So much like the Romans, I've also gone for an Armenian ally.
It's a nice ally, the Armenian.
It is, yes. You can see why the Romans valued them throughout all their wars with the Persians. So I've got a talented, instinctive army commander, another competent and a mediocre, with a talented, instinctive ally. Excuse me. The army has three allied units, an Armenian, two lots of Armenian lancers, sixes, average protected charging lancer, melee expert, And a unit of Armenian horse archers, average unprotected experience bow, combat shy. That's only the three UGGs for a talented, instinctive general, which may be a bit of an issue, but at least you'd hope that he should be reliable most of the time. The Persian component consists of two fours of Royal Azvaran, superior armoured horse, fully armoured, long spear, depth charger, shove, and three fours of average. Along with that, I've got two flexible horse archer units, form flexible, average unprotected experience bow, and a couple of skirmishers, average unprotected experience bow, one combat shy, one Cantabrian combat shy. So the army has 12 UGGs in total, 9 TUGs, 3 SUGs, and has a PBS of 7 and a scouting of 4. I basically chose it because it's nothing particularly special other than the obviously a solid punch of charging lance, cavalry and cataphracts. But there it is, supporting horse archers, pick your point and basically charge and hope you break through before you get surrounded and beaten.
Matt, I'll let you go first on this because you've used early Sassanid.
Yeah, I prefer the middle Sassanid because of the professional generals, but essentially they're very similar. Well, the way I use them, they're very similar. I don't know. I'm hung up on the fours of cataphracts.
The average ones.
I'm with you on this, Matt.
I'd almost prefer putting the two Azvarans into sixes and then putting the horse archers into fours.
I tell you what I'd be tempted to do, Matt, was agree, put all those average Azvaran into three fours, have two sixes, and swap out one of those Sassanid horse archers for a four of the form flexible horse archers.
Oh, take out the
would keep your nine, possibly even downgrading the Armenian ones. If you'd probably lose that, you probably wouldn't have a skirmish horse archer with Cantabrian. You'd have two left. You'd have the points for four of the flexible horse archers is a bit less than the cost of that six base Cantabrian unit in there. But that's how I'd be tempted to do it.
Other than, if I could get the two Azvarans in, the three Azvarans into two sixes and then still get the nine, it's a great list for what an early Sassanid should be, as far as I'm concerned. So, absolutely.
And another way of playing around is go, you've got 13 command cards there. Drop the ally to competent, get away with 12. That frees you up some points if you want it to do something with skirmishers. But 13's nice.
I like the 13. And I think a talented on that ally is actually pretty damn useful. I know it's four cards for two effective units.
Yeah, it means you really can't. You could deploy that in a sort of reserve position and be pretty damn sure you can get it where you need it, even if it's quite a way to go, because you'd be able to, the chances of not being able to double move if you've got four cards for two units of lancers and pulling along the horse archers is pretty low.
I think if you're running two fours of the Royals and two sixes of the Azvaran, you don't want that one being unreliable.
No,
it would really screw you over.
It is one of those where it does feel as if you want to guarantee it as much as you can.
But no, no, I like it because it's got loads of cataphracts and charging lancers, which is always a place I like to be with Sassanid Persian lists.
And you can have mountain terrain with plenty of forests.
Oh, well, there you see. You've sold it to me. I'll take
it. You've got mountains. You could actually place covered mountains on, couldn't you? You could be uphill in a forest.
See, I'm swinging you around to my way of thinking. You know, it won't be long before we'll all be fighting cataphracts in forests.
Yeah. I do like the idea of the fortified camp with that one as well.
I think that's a must with a lot of, if you're going for a small, shock-heavy Sassanid army, I really do think those fortified camps are a must.
Yeah.
From my point of view, because it just, and you've got fours as well, which, you know, Sod's Law would say they're the ones that will take a hit if your camp goes down.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you'll find one. Yeah, you'll find one that's lost a base somewhere on the line, and that's the one that'll roll a skull.
Yeah.
To go down to two bases whilst it's in combat.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I see we've all been there.
Never happens to your opponent, always happens to you.
Yes. Or at least maybe I just don't remember it happening to my opponent. Maybe I blank that out as a sort of reverse.
Sure. No, we all have perfect recall of the dice. This is well known. Yeah. No, I think we're fairly agreed on that one, aren't we? It's just the average Asran lancers.
Yeah, two sixes for the Asran, and maybe play about with the horse archers to keep you at nine tugs.
It's question. I think it comes out of question. Do you want the three skirmishing ones, or in which case you can put the flexible horse archers in fours, or would you be happy with two sixes and a four on that and only two skirmishers? So, you know, there's options there, and there's probably not a right answer. It's just the way I do it, or the way Matt would do it, perhaps. It's a thing. So, well, that one generally got the thumbs up. So we're more in favour of Shapur than we are of Zenobia, by the look of it, or Odenathus, perhaps, with the Roman legion is there. So we're more Sassanidophiles rather than Palmyrenophiles. So I don't know what that says about us. Okay, should we move on to my second list, which, as might have hinted earlier, it's an Imperial Roman. So we're sort of topping and tailing this with a Roman that could be from around the start of the crisis of the 3rd century and an Imperial Roman, which is more at the end. Although, if I'm being honest, I've dated this a couple of years after the ascension of Diocletian, just because of the options I wanted. So, you know, the crisis didn't just end at his ascension. There was lots to do. But, because it also means I can take one from the other end of the empire as well. So,
yeah.
Nice. Yeah. And we should say as well that the Imperial Roman, or often called late Imperial Roman for wargaming historical reasons, doesn't just come in with Diocletian. It actually starts earlier, around about the time of Aurelian, if I remember rightly.
Doesn't it cover Gallienus as well?
It might cover Gallienus as well. Yeah. It certainly sort of comes in during the 3rd century crisis rather than at the end of it, which is maybe a more wargamer's traditional one. But, you know, we like to be a bit iconoclastic when we're doing these lists, don't we, Richard? And maybe think a bit more about these transition dates. But in the end, they're all a bit arbitrary, as we know. Nothing changed overnight. Only happens in war games lists. Anyway, this is an Imperial Roman. As I said, I've gone from the other end of the empire. I've moved from Syria. This one's in Britain. And I've dated it 286, because then that fits with the rebellion of Carausius in Britain and Northern Gaul. I probably mispronounced his name, which means that no doubt Dr. Elliot will beat me up next time he sees me, because he's written a book on them, on it. But it was sort of another breakaway Roman Empire based in Britain and Northern Gaul. So, and the reason I've gone for that is this one again has an ally, and the allies are early Franks, which Carausius did use. You know, he's documented as having Frankish mercenaries in his army. So this is my take on his army for that. Again, poor fortified camp, because Romans, you know, Imperial Romans have to have a fortified camp. Again, I've gone for four competent generals, one of which is an ally, The other three are all professional. And I, to head off questions here, I am possibly an open question about whether the ally might be better off being talented than competent, but I will see what my fellow podcasters think about that. So it has some similarities with the previous list I did. I've got 2-4 base units of the Equites, drilled loose, average protected, unskilled javelin, short spear. One of them is shoot and charge. On that classic, I had some points left over and could just squeeze the shoot and charge in. Couldn't get it to both units, tragically. So, you know, that just guarantees the one unit that's got shoot and charge will never be in a position to shoot and charge, whilst the other one will get it every down move. I've then gone for 3 units of veteran legionaries. All 6s, drilled, flexible, superior protected, impact weapon, shield cover, melee expert. A good grunt thump. 2 units of average legionaries. These are 6 bases, but again, like my previous one of the bases has the experienced bolt shooters, but these are 6s, not 4s. So they're all impact weapon, shield cover, melee expert. These ones I've gone for integral shooters. And as I say, one of the bases has the experienced bolt shooter ability added. So they're a bit bigger. And again, you know, my thinking on the integral shooters here is that slightly defensive thing. Not giving it to the veteran legionaries because I expect them to be getting stuck in pretty much regardless whenever they can. But the other ones perhaps a little bit more defensive, especially if they're trying to ping at something with their bolt shooters. The last Roman unit. Now, this is one I just like. And again, this is personal preference and maybe a bit daft, but I like using them. It's the Lanciarii, infantry skirmisher, average protected, experienced javelin, short spear, shoot and charge, and melee expert. Which, you know, makes them 53 points a base for a javelin arm skirmisher. I just like them.
Stick them on a mountain and let people think they can dislodge them. They'll regret it.
Yeah. Or if somebody's got an isolated skirmishing cavalry unit, they can rip them up. I like them, so that's why I've included them. The Frankish ally is 4 Uggs. 3 of them are Tugs, 1's a Sug. The Tugs are a 6 base unit of best foot warriors, infantry, tribal, flexible, superior protected, short spear, devastating charger, and then 2 units of foot warriors, which are 9 base units of tribal, flexible, average protected, short spear, devastating charger. They have to have a skirmisher unit. There's some compulsory skirmishers in their list. They've got a 6 base unit of infantry skirmishers, poor, unprotected, experienced, bow, combat shy. So they, you know, there's 3 pretty impactful infantry units. The foot warriors, they're it's all in the charge for them. The best foot warriors, they're only a 6, but they're superior, so they can carry on fighting to some more effect in the melee phase. 10 Tugs, 2 Sugs. So, you know, you can play those psychological games, as Matt alluded to, with 10 Tugs. If you put one in ambush, people will go, oh, there's about to be 9. If you've got 10 on the table and put an ambush, people might think you've got 11 and you've got one in ambush. So your bluff, they might think, is real. But if you put a real one in ambush, they might think it's not there because you're bluffing. So you can play around with that. So this is a more infantry based version. Would probably therefore want a reasonable chunk of terrain on the table so that they can't be ridden around. But, you know, the poor fortified camp means that raiding cavalry aren't going to take it out. Anyway, there we are, chaps. An Imperial Roman in Britain.
Nice.
Yeah, I'll second
I'll take that and run. Richard says nice, I'm going to take that.
The superior legions and combined with the barbarian troops is a nice combination. Haven't seen it used with the bolt shooter legionaries before.
Again, so it's 120 points for those two editions of the bolt shooters.
Yep. Why not? Equivalent to about one legionary. So
And also the thing is, when you apply, if they've got the bolt shooters in, those tugs count as missile focused. So even if they're within one base width, they won't be forced charging. So you don't have to hold them to try and keep the integral shooters in play.
No, and they scare elephants, and they can scare chariots, and
they can really irritate cataphracts. Oh, you've got we don't care about all your armor.
Yes.
And if you gang the two bolt shooters up on a cataphract unit, two whites, get a lucky shot, knock a base off with two wounds, that can really irritate the cataphract. Especially if it was one of your fours of superior, Richard.
Yes, indeed. Mm. And the equites doing the usual equites job.
They're just to muck around, really. Yeah. Or as you said in the other list, they can be a good, if you don't have to worry about flanks for whatever reason, there's a nice reserve.
Yeah, you do probably want some terrain.
Yes,
that's for sure. But other than that, nasty. Wouldn't want particularly want to face that.
Yeah, and I do think I was very keen to have those two Frankish foot warriors in nines as well, just for that extra, just hang around a little bit longer.
It's an army that can deploy if it's outscouted, because with two scouting cards, you may be outscouted significantly, but it's a straightforward deployment. Your enemy isn't going to get a huge advantage by seeing you deploy first. If you deploy carefully,
yeah.
It's just pick where you put the Franks, I guess.
It is, yeah. But even if it's a bit obvious where they go, they're pretty powerful.
Yeah, I mean, they'll hold up most things and have a chance of winning.
Matt?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's one of those armies that actually works better if you can smear the table with terrain, because the entire army can operate in terrain. Well, by your equites, but that's not a problem.
They're only allowed in forests.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
just to tediously extend that joke.
No, I really like that. It's I've yet to see somebody use a Roman army in competition where their primary focus is to smear the table in terrain. I genuinely think the Roman armies fight better with a lot of terrain on the table, because they just don't care. They're terrain agnostic.
They are. I think whenever I've used my Romans, I've not particularly bothered about terrain, but I've never gone to lay it down, other than maybe, I'll have a secure flank just to narrow it a bit, the deep water, just to narrow the table a little bit, because these Roman armies are not always that wide, things like that. But and also against some of the barbarian armies, you probably want the legionaries fighting in the open as close formation, so they've got the possibility of shove.
True.
I think as long as you've got some, I wouldn't deliberately go out to smear the table with terrain, but as long as you've got some terrain, you're certainly not bothered if there's more of it gets put down. My problem is I never managed to smear the table with terrain on the rare occasions I have an army that's looking to do that. But I always seem to have an opponent who rolls a six when six. I don't want them to.
Yeah. You always end up on a billiard table whenever you think, we're in very dense terrain, and you'll have two small woods or something at the back of the table, and that'll be it.
But this one, you could quite viably go for lots of terrain. The early one, which had the Armenian ally, you wouldn't want to overdo it because it would get in the way of the Armenians. Indeed.
Yeah, but make
them too predictable. If there's only one lane for them and the opponent's got something that can really stop them, it sort of takes them out of the game.
Yeah, but in this case, this Imperial Roman, say, if you put up against something like the classic later Crusader army, or maybe one of the samurai armies, or something along those lines.
Where
if you didn't get a lot of terrain, you're not that badly compromised. But by putting a lot of terrain down, you are actually wrecking their army before they've even deployed.
Yeah, I mean, it's something like samurai. I'll face those long spears in terrain because I'm impact weapon melee expert. I'm just better.
Yeah.
You know, and if I know they're going to be in terrain, excellent. I know where I've got to go.
Well, that's just the thing. Maybe I'll do it at some point. I'll take a Roman army and resolutely fight four games in planes when I fail to get any terrain at any point and prove my point.
Yeah, but the advantage of the Romans is they fight in terrain, in the plains anyway, so.
Yeah.
You know, and with this one, if it had only a bit of terrain, you'd probably think about putting the Franks there. And, yeah. Here's one thing on both these Roman armies I've chosen is I've not even thought about the exceptionals. I think the Roman exceptionals are now just a little bit too expensive to fit into an army that I like. Now, that's my personal choice in army composition.
I think it's now a much more nuanced decision.
Yes.
With the 2024 lists. With the earlier lists, I think it was
a no-brainer.
I always had them. You know, yeah. even if they don't have melee expert, they were only a few points more expensive than a veteran legion, and they're one factor better in the charge and the same in melee phase for about 5 points a base. It was a no-brainer. You're right. It is more nuanced.
I am pretty much immune to skill choosing beyond.
Yes. That advantage alone was fantastic. Yes, shield cover, and you're not getting the S equals a wound.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah. I'm not saying they're too expensive that you'd never use them, but in the style, the two armies I've picked, what I was looking for in the armies, they wouldn't really have fitted in, or I'd have had to have a four.
No, I think the balance and the points now is, as Richard said, it's much more nuanced. And I don't, as you said, it's not too expensive from my point of view. It's just what you want to do with the army.
Yes.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, in a different army, I can still see me using them, just because those advantages, extra fact. You know, you got four claims in charge phase, with two for your impact weapon, two for your exceptional. You know, if you're in an environment where you're likely to get skilled shooters, they're not. They're essentially experienced. It's really good, and the one where you can break off for equal speed, take a cab. Oh, it's only a white.
Yeah. If you're not already carrying the wound or not feeling physically unlucky.
Yeah, and then you're back to charge phase combat where you've got a massive four claims. You know, but it is picking the right army for them now. So there we go. Right.
One random thing I will say about your bolt shooters and your infantry is you're up against chariots, but you're not up against hoplite foot mounted in chariots.
Let's just not go there today.
Sorry. The randomness of the rules. You can be stood next to a chariot formation and they will suffer to the bolt shooters, but your foot in chariots are not.
Yes. We know there are some inconsistencies and oddities around that. That's we'll put that one as out of bounds for tonight, Matt. but it's true. Yeah, it's because they are not chariotry.
Yes,
they're mounted infantry who move. They shot at its foot, and there's movers chariots. Okie dokie. So that's the army list. We've been ticking on a little while. I just wanted to thought if we've got any thoughts on figures for the third century crisis. I've got an immediate thought that you can't, in 15 mil, you can't get a proper third century Roman legionary. You can in 28 mil. A&A miniatures do them. I've got some for 28 mil army. They're lovely, big and chunky. But people don't do them. Except maybe you could possibly say that the very end of the third century is you starting to get that late Roman ridge helmet look. But for a big chunk of it, you can't get them in like mail and scale and maybe still a bit of segmentata, oval shields more than the rectangular ones. And the helmets are quite distinctive.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about it, but now you've pointed it out.
I think I only know that because I've got the 28 mil A&A ones, which are quite really rather nice. That's a one you can't get, though I'm sure because of that, nobody will complain. But I think you can get Roman legionaries in segmentata with oval shields and Imperial Gallic style helmets. And so they, you know, take your usual late Roman with the ridge helmets and mail for the late end, you know, a bit like that army I just did, but it's sort of the more the middling bit. Anyway, that was my what you can't get. Any thoughts that people have got on particularly nice figures for these sort of armies that they've come across or used?
Silence from
the tumbleweed blows. I mean, obviously,
I'm not an expert on those.
No, there's quite a lot of people do like Palmyran cataphracts, which are based quite heavily on some well-known images, a bit like the, you know, the cataphract graffiti from Dura Europas.
Yeah.
You know, I've had a lot of sort of mixed cataphracts of that sort of style. You can get a nice unit out of some mixed ones. I think a lot of the, you know, that early Sassanid, you're looking at quite, in war games figures terms, are going to be quite Parthian looking rather than what people have generally used for Sassanids, which are either a bit not imaginary, they're misinterpretations of some of the iconography. But, you know, they're those light bulb helmet hats, for instance. But they all come a bit later. So.
Indeed.
But also just something I was going to mention before we did this was none of us went for any of the Northern Barbarians when we chose our list. And I must admit, I looked and went, God, they're dull.
Yeah, that was pretty much my take on it.
Well, I've done the Quadi, I think, in the past in one of our podcasts.
I think you did, yes.
So I avoided that. Yeah. That's why I went for the Persians.
Yeah, I think I was mainly looking at things like the Franks, Alemanni, Goths, you know, the infantry based ones rather than ones with more cavalry.
Yeah, there are some quite interesting combinations for the Marcomannic Wars of you can have Chatti, Alemanni and Quadi together in a some combination like that.
Yeah, that's the second century, isn't it?
Yeah, that's Marcus Aurelius. But I think the third century ones are probably a bit duller, fair to say.
Yeah, because I did remember that the Franks can have their unit of fanatic infantry. So I thought, that's quite nice. They can't have it in an allied contingent. They used to be able to till a few years ago, and then
I wonder who decided that. I wonder.
Well, no, quite rightly. You know, it's one of those. It's like we don't allow Praetorians in allied contingents. You know, So I thought, I'll look at that because there could be something. So I think is an ally to make it. No, it's just going to be this huge mass of tribal, flexible, average, short spear, devastating charger. So it just didn't appeal to me. Some people like that sort of thing. Huge mass, line it up and just throw it forward and roll a million dice very quickly. You know, it doesn't appeal to me.
Yeah, sorry, Matt. Or don't throw dice quickly, which is the big killer of those armies. People don't. They faff. How you faff with a mono-dimensional barbarian army? I don't know. People manage it.
Yes, the only way it's going to kill people is get it to melee. So the sooner you get there, the sooner you're rolling dice. And I think that's where the nine base units come in. Sometimes, you know, just that they just hang around that a little bit longer. So you just roll dice for one turn more, which could just be enough. But yeah, but I think so. We were fairly agreed. The third century, not wildly exciting for the barbarian foot armies.
Yeah, from the history perspective, I suppose I'm impressed actually how resilient the Roman Empire is after all the lists of invasions that went on. Mm. And it does recover. In some ways that's quite remarkable.
I've seen in more than one historian has sort of commented, you know, on the main things about the Roman Empire, you know, whilst we all know, certainly for the West, it declined and fell. But actually, that isn't the surprising thing. The surprising thing is it took so long before it fell.
Yeah.
You know, given, you know, an awful lot of empires just don't last that long. But there's that period, because you get obviously the Sassanid Empire lasted 400 or 500 years. The Parthians lasted similar lengths of time. There were just that bit around, the early late antiquity, Roman period, where there were two or three really long lasting empires.
Yeah. I mean, in many ways, you can actually regard the Parthian Sassanid Empire as being one continuous empire, which just happened to have a change of dynasty in the middle.
I am pretty much signed up to that sort of view on it. I think that's the ruling house changed from the Arsacids to the Sassanids. Because even right at the end of the Sassanid Empire, you've got those great Parthian families like the Suren.
Indeed,
are still there. They've been there for the.
And quite a few of them survive into the early Islamic period as well.
Yes, I'm not sure the Suren do, but there are some that do.
Yeah,
the Karens and the Mirans, I think.
You're probably more familiar with that period than I am.
There's an extremely good book on the end of it by somebody, is it Poor Sharati or something? She's I think she's either Iranian or certainly of Iranian descent. Done a big thick book it's supposed to be on the end of the Sassanid Empire, but it actually covers quite a lot of the history or that background of the great families, and does emphasize continuity role. Yeah. So anyway, so we're sort of moving away there. So okay, so we've not got too much in the way of figures jumping out at us as especially good, but I think there are plenty of figures for the period. A lot of manufacturers do Parthians, Sassanids, Romans of various types. You know, there's northern barbarians that would cover all those Franks, Goths, Alemanni, Quadi, as well. And the one that you mentioned that we haven't touched on at all were the Blemmi. If you want to go really left field. I was a bit disappointed that Matt didn't bring a Blemmi. I thought if any of us were going to, it was going to be Matt.
Yes.
It was even too much for you, was it, Matt? Well, not enough cataphracts, like none.
Yeah, no. Or lack of decent camelry or anything. It just, as a list, it was just massed bow, effectively. Yeah. And that does not light my fire, shall we say. it would probably look quite pretty for some of the unit types and what you could put on the table, but no.
I th- that's one that somebody like Paul Stavell
Oh, we probably
would probably look at and come out with an army that we'll go, hey, how come he's how come he's won the competition with that?
There's your challenge, Paul.
Yeah, so that's all for Paul. Paul, next time you have a possibility, Blemmy for you. Actually, I've got a feeling that it covered the Blemmy and the Nobardes, and I think it's a bit more interesting with the Nobardes.
Yeah, I think they're allowed some better foot.
Yeah, I think they get some sort
of spearmen.
Yeah, some sort of solidish foot, don't they? So, yeah. Anyway, it obviously didn't ring our bells. So, okay, I think we're sort of drifting a bit now. So maybe we'd move to the any other business part of this. Anything we want to highlight? Richard, you've usually got your hand on the pulse for these sort of things, or finger on the pulse even. hand round the throat, finger on the pulse.
Yeah, and I've been measuring my blood pressure. The Society of Ancients Battle Day is on the Sunday, the 24th of March, coming up, at which we will be running the battle itself is the Battle of Ilipa, and we will be running a Meg game, along with all the other rule sets that will be played. This is being held at Thatcham Village Hall near Newbury. And if anybody wishes to come along, you don't have to be a Society of Ancients member to do so. And you'd be very welcome.
Until you join. You can get in, but you can't get out.
You would be able to join, but you're not forced to. And there'll be an excellent introductory presentation by Simon McDowell, I'm sure. So. The Ilipa, for anybody who isn't aware, is the decisive battle in Spain during the Second Punic War, Scipio swaps the deployment and beats the Carthaginians.
That's good. I would just say that there's a couple of competitions coming up for those in competitions. There's one in Preston. I think it's the weekend before the Society of Ancients Battle Day, being run by Pete Entwistle and Jeff Pearson, which is. Yep. Sorry, Richard.
Yes, that's there. Is it Mongols and something like that?
Yeah, it's sort of broadly called Northern Crusades and Mongols or something like that. But the it's a bit different in that you will play two games with a 10,000 point army and two games with an 8,500 point army. Both armies are the same army list, and there are some restrictions. If you take an ally, you have to use the same ally. And they're going to have some special rules yet to be revealed about what happens when a 10k army meets an 8.5k army. So, but anyway, I'm going up to that because I'm looking. I think that's just really a bit different. That's really piqued my interest. So I'm going to make my way up to Preston for that one. And then the weekend after the Society of Ancients is Poyle in Derby, Time of Insufficient Light. The we don't use the term Dark Ages anymore, honest. Run by Will Denham at Boards and Sword Hobby. And the weekend after that, it's all a bit packed at the moment, is Roll Call in Cranfield with the 28mm Meg Open.
And in fact, on the same weekend as the Society of Ancients Battle Day is the Meg Pacto campaign event, being held at Battlefield Hobbies in Devonshire, being arranged by Simon Stokes.
Indeed.
Which I will be present on the Saturday.
Yes.
So you don't have to go for both days.
Yeah, I had been hoping to go for one day because I'm still planning to go to the Society of Ancients. But unfortunately, life's got in the way and I can't do both of them. So it's more convenient for me to do the battle day, which is a shame because, as Richard has said, you can go for one day. So if you're interested, get in touch with Simon Stokes. Details are on the forum, of course. Put a link in the notes for this. So it's a busy sort of time. There's plenty of opportunities in March and early April.
There are indeed, yes.
Yeah. Matt, anything you're aware of that we haven't mentioned or anything you think people should know?
There's the Kent Bash this weekend, I think.
Yes,
we're recording this on a Thursday, and unless you are editing it very efficiently.
Good point, well made. Yes.
The Kent Clash will have been held by the time people listen to this. But it's a Vikings theme, armies and enemies of the Vikings. Some serious competitors have entered this year. Bunshot people and people who actually know what they're doing tactically. So,
yeah, I'm going, and even if I know what I'm doing, and this year's results are suggesting otherwise, I feel my army choice. Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting.
There are going to be a lot of thematic Byzantines and Normans and Vikings in Normandy and feudal French and that sort of thing. So good luck.
It is, you know, it's been organised by Peter Cross at a school near him, which apparently is really nice. He's used it before. So, I'm certainly looking forward to it. So for Peter's benefit, the reason I didn't mention it is it's a point Richard made at the beginning. I assume by the time this comes out, it will have been and gone. And I may have won last place prize. I feel I'm well in the competition for it. And I'm taking later thematic Byzantine.
One other point I'd like to mention is, if people aren't aware, they ought to be, the chariot lists have been upgraded with battles and campaigns. So I've identified 250 separate battles and campaigns for the four list sets, which
that's actually quite astonishing for the period.
Yes, given the paucity of sources, I was quite impressed with.
Yeah. When I drew up my early imperial Roman list for tonight, I did notice there are over three pages worth of the list of battles for them goes over three pages, the column. So
yes. Indeed.
There's an awful lot being listed there. It's an impressive piece of work.
I'm now getting stuck into the early medieval period and getting my head blown away by all the different Arab. I've got to the Abbasid Caliphate and it's horrible. not least because sadly a lot of the battles don't seem to have been actually named by the historians. So I came across an example where there is a battle on the Euphrates.
Well, that narrows it down, doesn't it?
Yes, I was going to say. So that could be anywhere from Armenia through to Basra, I suppose. But
I think when you get to the Zand revolt part of the Abbasids, there's about 5 years of fighting, and I think it's just all in marshes round Basra.
Right.
Yeah. And I think there might be another town mentioned, but that's about it.
Kufa, I think, might be the other one. But that seems to appear quite a lot in various revolts.
Kufa has been somewhat replaced by... No, I think that the Zanj sort of use another town or something near Basra as a almost like a capital. And yeah, mind you, a lot of the battles there were basically fought on the river or in the marshes. It's a very, very wet campaign. I don't envy you on that. So, but it's a monumental piece of work.
I'm learning an awful lot of history, I must say.
That's good. Okay, well, perhaps at this point, on that note, as Richard tries to find out where on the Euphrates these battles took place. Otherwise, we'll have 20 battles of the Euphrates. Pick your point, anywhere on a couple of thousand miles. Perhaps we shall draw this one to a close. So obviously, as ever, Richard, thank you so much for the history, because it's yet another complicated and confusing period of history. Thanks everybody for their army lists and contributions. And for all you listeners out there, I hope it's been interesting as ever. We'd love some feedback, ideas for future podcasts, always welcome. You know, and equally, you know, if there are some bits of it you don't particularly like for whatever reason, a bit of constructive criticism is also very much appreciated. So on that note, I will say ta-ra and see some of you over a table at one of these competitions or gatherings at some point, and enjoy your wargaming.